ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. I'm one of your hosts today. My name is Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here. Special guest host with me today is Margaret, who from our senior leader team. Margaret, tell them a little bit about yourself, Margaret Brill.
Thanks, Chris. I'm Margaret Brill. I'm the vice president of EAA Aviation Foundation and also oversee our marketing and membership here at EAA.
Well, Margaret helps make all the mission-based things we do here happen, so it's fun to get to interview a guest here with her today. And what a guest we have. I am really stoked about this. Maybe a couple weeks ago, Margaret sent me a text and was like, hey, would you like to have Michelle or Mace on the program? And I'm like, oh my God, yeah. So over the last couple weeks, I've been really looking forward to this day. So without further ado, let's bring on our guest, who is Michelle Mace Curran.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I'm sure we're going to get into it, but I'm excited being from Wisconsin and obviously with my aviation background. This is such an easy yes for me.
That is awesome. This is so much fun. Thank you so much for being here. Like I said, I always enjoy all of these, but there are some that you're like, oh, I can't wait to do that one. And this is certainly one of those episodes. My favorite question to ask, I think I do it every episode. Everybody laughs by this point, I'm sure. But what first got you sort of interested or started in aviation?
I wish that I was going to say that I came to Oshkosh as a kid because I grew up in Medford, Wisconsin, which is only like 2 hours away. But I did not grow up in an aviation or a military family. So I just really didn't even know it was a thing, which I'm very sad about now that I've been there many times. I really missed out. But I needed a way to pay for college. And my parents kind of suggested that I look into ROTC, which I actually was resistant to at first. But once I started poking around, I was an adventurous kid. I wanted to travel the world, and the military seemed like a good opportunity to do those things. And at that time, though, when I went into college on what ended up being an ROTC scholarship, I actually didn't want to fly yet. Or I didn't not want to fly. I just wasn't sure that that was the right thing for me. I just didn't know anything about it. So I went to college as a criminal justice major with the plan on graduating with that, doing 4 years in the Air Force to pay back my scholarship, and then getting out and applying to the FBI. That was my grand plan as like a 17-year-old. But halfway through college with my ROTC detachment, we visited Tyndall Air Force Base down in Florida, and I got to see two F-15s take off, one after the other, in full AB at dusk. So you kind of have like the setting Florida sun, mm-hmm. starting to get dark, that giant orange afterburner flame coming out of the engines. Jet noise just vibrates your whole body. I mean, you all have experienced it. Mm-hmm. It's an insane thing to see. And I just had this like visceral, excited response where I was just like, forget the FBI. I have to go try that. And my personality is when I decide I want to do something, I run full speed towards it until I make it happen or I run into a brick wall. And so I did that for the next 5-ish years and landed myself in the cockpit of an F-16.
Wow. There's so much to unpack there.
Yeah, that was a lot.
I love that you were going to go for something completely different. I have a friend, she was going to be an accountant and then saw Top Gun and decided to go and fly the F-14. And so Megan ended up as a Tomcat and Hornet pilot. So I couldn't imagine you as criminal justice soaring through the skies in an F-16. So that's, thank God that F-15 was taken off at the right time.
Yeah, I think I had an upgrade, and I would say the same thing for the accountant, definitely an upgrade.
Oh, yeah.
No offense to the accountants listening.
So let me ask you, can you tell me a little bit about what was your first impression walking in the door and going through, you know, basic training and your first, you know, experience in the Air Force? What did you think at first?
So I guess it's kind of, I think of it in two parts. Like ROTC introduces you to the military isms, like customs and courtesies and uniforms and marching and rank and all of just like the really basic military things. And that was intimidating. Not going to lie, it was very stressful, but I also realized that I kind of thrived in that environment where it was like a very structured path to success. The criteria was laid out, you know, you knew exactly what you needed to do well. And even though it was hard, I found it really rewarding. Then you kind of fast forward to flight training, where again, I walk in the door and it's very intimidating. I also went into undergraduate pilot training with zero civilian flight time. So I had no general aviation background. I think I had ridden in a Cessna on a FAM flight like one time before I got there. So it was definitely drinking from a fire hose.
That's incredible to have zero GA time or experience or anything like that going into this.
So I know part of that is personality, but how do you just push through all of that and say, yeah, I'm going to keep going?
I think at that, you know, I'm early 20s at this point. And so the level of energy, I always joke now I'm 37 and I'm like, I could not go back to pilot training and do the pace that I did then. Like I just can't memorize at that rate anymore. And also just the 12-hour days nonstop for a year was a lot. But again, I think the Air Force does a really good job of laying out exactly what the path to success is.
Sure.
They're like, hey, here is the exact criteria you're being graded on for this flight. Here is the syllabus. So you know you're going to have these academic tests and then these sim flights and then these actual flights. And so I was very good. I was a good student growing up. Mm-hmm. And so kind of that same mentality of studying really hard and now it's being prepared and managing my time and all that stuff that I had done in school that allowed me to get an ROTC scholarship really, really served me well, especially at the beginning of pilot training, where so much of it is memorization and academics. And when I did well in that portion, because of just my personality and the study habits I had, I think that kind of gave me the confidence as we got into the actual flying, that this was a place I could actually excel in.
For sure.
And I remember my dollar ride. So my very first flight in the T6, and my instructor was this older guy, a reservist lieutenant colonel. And he was like briefing me, and the whole briefing, he was saying these things where it sounded like he was trying to kind of give me assurance for nerves, but I had no nerves. I was just pure excited. He's like, how are you feeling about this? Are you nervous? And I was like, no, I'm excited. Why? Like, it blew my mind that I should be nervous. And I think that energy of just like naive enthusiasm gave me so much momentum out the gate. And then I did naturally take to it. I would say I didn't deal with any air sickness. I was just really good at memorizing all the things. So that helped so much with learning ground ops and radio calls and all of that stuff. And so I feel like I almost got this head start right out the gate because of just some natural strengths that I have.
Yeah.
And that just gave me the confidence to just charge ahead.
Well, and you know, for those who maybe aren't as familiar with, you know, military aviation, flying fighters is, it is the pinnacle of your military career, of someone who wants to be involved in aviation. I mean, that is for many people, that's how they view it, is that is the highest, you know, you can go as far as like flying in the military aircraft. And I've never met anybody who basically, you know, for a sports equivalent, you kind of picked up a football and threw it and were like, yeah, I think I'm going to go play for the Packers. I mean, that is incredible. I still sort of hung up on that. That's just amazing.
I will say that that was how it started. I definitely started to hit hiccups in the road as I got into not so much the T-38, which is what we went to after the T-6, if you were in the portion of the class that was in the fighter bomber track, but after I graduated pilot training and got into the F-16, the standard, like just what you all mentioned, the standard goes up so much in that jump that it's a really hard jump to make. And everyone is terrible at first. And being this kind of like high achieving perfectionist, super driven, getting there and just realizing that it was going to take years to get my arms around these new skills in this new platform, I started to struggle at that point because it shook my identity, because I was used to being that one that was just good at things. You know, I worked my butt off, but I was willing to do that. And I get to an F-16 squadron. Doesn't matter how hard I work, I am now just bad because it's so hard and you're a beginner. And that kind of sent me through this identity crisis for a while.
And I think that that speaks volumes to even anybody going through general aviation training, because there were times where, like, you know, I went into to learning to fly knowing and appreciating airplanes already. So I was kind of like, I got this. And for a few things I did, you know, and I was really good at it. And then suddenly I'd hit something that I hit a wall where I'm like, I don't know why I can't figure this out. And then for the next like 2 weeks, you just feel like the worst student pilot in the country, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. You just went through it. You've been a pilot now for about a couple years?
No, just a couple months. I just got my private in December, but right before I went to do my check ride, probably a month or so before, I got the yips. I said, I just got very nervous and I thought, okay, I can't do this. Yeah. And yeah, you have to push through that and tell yourself that you can, but that's a tough place to be. And you know, a lot of it is mental, right?
Yeah.
So
Navigation was it for me. I hated navigation. I couldn't. If I stayed in a pattern, I was like, let me just stay in a pattern my whole career. I'll just do that. And you're like, no, you have to figure out how to go places. So
Michelle, do you have any tips or tricks on how to mentally get past that and get out of that space?
Yeah, for sure. And I think what we're talking about, to put, you know, kind of the buzz phrase on it, is that imposter syndrome that you hear about, where all of a sudden you question whether you deserve to be in the position you're in, and you start to doubt if you are a person that has the potential to even make it through, and you feel like everyone around you is better than you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think there's a couple of things. The first thing is realizing how normal it is. Like, all three of us are like, yep. Been there. I talk to so many student pilots who are going through their instrument, and instruments are hard, right? Like, I'm a little rusty at the moment. And if someone was like, go enter holding, I would be like, vectors to final, please. It's hard. And it's like such a foreign concept if you've never done it before. And I just think anytime you're a beginner at something that is worth doing, that is difficult, which aviation definitely falls into that category, you're going to have that time frame where you don't have the skills yet. And so your competence level isn't quite there because you're learning. And I think that confidence is built when you prove to yourself how capable you are, right? So confidence comes from this proven track record of, yes, I can do this thing, and you don't have it yet. And you're constantly being evaluated, right? Because you're doing all of these graded flights, you're with an instructor, you have check rides. And so acknowledging that this is normal, talking about it like it's normal, like going to your flight instructor, going to a peer who's in a similar program, or an experienced aviator that's a mentor, any of those, and just being like, hey, I'm at this point where I'm really questioning my abilities. Here's some of the things that have happened. Here's what I'm worried about. Even just talking about it out loud, getting it out of your head, makes you realize sometimes just how irrational it is.
Absolutely. Yes. I had a group of people that I could go and talk to and say, okay, this is what I'm thinking, or this is how I feel. And them being able to say, yep, that's normal, or you got to look at it from this perspective. And that is what probably got me through to the end, was the people around me.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I talk about a lot in just all the different platforms that I have, is like this inner critic that we have, that like inner narrative that questions our abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it comes from some past experience we've had. Like, I do some workshops on this, and people will share their inner critics, and it will be like a super critical coach they had growing up, or a parent that criticized them a lot, or anyone that they felt like put a ridiculous amount of pressure on them, usually as a kid. And that person's voice is coming back, even though that person might be dead, they might not be involved at all in this. Mm-hmm. Their voice is coming back and causing them to question their worth and whether they deserve to be doing the thing, because it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I just wonder, and would love to know the answer, did you feel any pressure too? I mean, because you're a woman, and that's still somewhat of a minority in the military combat role. Did you feel any sort of extra pressure or anything like that?
Absolutely. And I wish I could say, no, I just wanted to fly. It wasn't a thing. The jet doesn't care about your gender, which is all true. It's all true, right? The jet does not care.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as unforgiving, no matter who you are. But I 100%, and it took me a while to get perspective on this, and a lot of it has come in the last few years after I've left the military. I was the only woman in my pilot training class. So class of 25, just me. My first F-16 squadron, there were two of us in a squadron of about 50 pilots. And then my next two units, it was just me again. And when I came into military aviation, about 2% of fighter pilots were female. Now it's about 4%.
Mm-hmm.
So it is extremely uncommon still. My progress is slow, obviously, based on those numbers. And what I realized is that I rarely dealt with any sort of like overt sexism. Like, it wasn't a hostile environment by any means. And I've heard the stories from the women who were in the first round, you know, that came in after the Combat Exclusion Act was repealed in the early 90s. They dealt with some really terrible things. And it makes it seem like the stuff that I dealt with should be so minor. But the perspective I have now is that during that time where I'm new to an F-16 squadron and I'm dealing with those feelings of imposter syndrome, that I felt like I was under a microscope and that I had this extra responsibility where whether I was really good at a certain skill, say that's dogfighting or it's air to ground or whatever it is, or I struggled with it, that was now creating the reputation for what female fighter pilots were good at.
That's a lot of pressure.
It is. I saw that play out. And it felt like, so that was one part of it, is the skills in the aircraft. Like, this is not just my reputation on the line. It's all the other women who are in this career field. Mm-hmm. The second part was, a fighter squadron is still very much a work hard, play hard environment. And that's how you deal with how stressful it is. And that's how you create, you know, trust and camaraderie. Mm-hmm. But when I came in, the Air Force was going through a transition where they were really trying to get away from kind of the good old boys club vibe, where a lot of the humor and kind of traditions were very sexist. Like, they were working hard to change that, because that layer of it is not required to have that work hard, play hard mentality. Like, there's so many other ways to do it. And it still would come up once in a while. And anytime something was said, every head in the room would turn and look at me and wait for my reaction. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, maybe 24, 25 years old at this point. I'm one of the lowest ranking people in the squadron. I'm just trying to figure out my footing in this aircraft and learn this difficult job. And I also felt like I had the responsibility with how I reacted in those moments, whether I laughed along with the joke that made me uncomfortable, or whether I just stood there stone-faced, or whether I had the courage to speak up and be like, could you not? You know?
Yeah, that's a whole nother layer.
Yep, that not only affected the environment I was operating in and how these people respected me, but it also was creating the environment that the next woman that came into that squadron was going to have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And so if I was okay to just go with the flow and laugh at something to try to fit in, I was not just sacrificing like my authenticity, but I was also setting the next woman up for failure. And again, that felt like a ton of responsibility.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than just flying the jet. I mean,
it's
there's
so
a lot
more
riding with your career here, you know, I mean, with your course of action. So let me discuss briefly, because I know we hinted around it, but can you tell me the progression of aircraft you trained to get into the F-16?
Yep. So I went to initial flight screening in Pueblo, Colorado, which is about a month long. And that is literally like brand new first exposure to aviation. You're flying the DA-20. And, you know, it's a little airplane. You sit next to each other. Your Velcro gets stuck to your instructor's Velcro because it's very tight in there. And I think we would putter around at like 80 knots. and you're just learning the pure basics, like how to taxi, how to turn the airplane on, like all of the basic ground school things. And it's really, you know, initial flight screening. It's really a program to weed out people that don't have the aptitude to go on to the next aircraft, which was the T-6, because you're going from something with a giant wing that can glide forever, that's very forgiving. And then once you pass that program, now you're officially in Air Force undergraduate pilot training. So now you're going to the T-6, which can fly like 300 knots. It can pull 6 Gs. It's fully aerobatic. You're going to fly formation. You're going to fly instruments. So I get why IFS is there, but the leap from the Katana to the T-6 is quite a big one. Mm-hmm. And then you fly that for 6 months. Everyone does. You kind of get, or not kind of, you get racked and stacked at the end of that time. So, you know, first through 25th in the class, the flight commander has that all laid out. And then they ask, hey, who wants to try to go to the T-38, to the little jet trainer for the fighter bomber track? And you have to be in the top half of your class to even be eligible. And then they only generally have a handful of spots. So my class, I think there were 6 of us. And so there were some people that wanted it that didn't make it. I ended up, you know, making it through, again, that gate to go into the T-38. Flew that for another 6 months. Graduated from there. And we had, before graduation, our drop night, where you get to fill out your dream sheet, list all of the aircraft the Air Force has with your preferences, one through however many. And then the squadron commander works with the big Air Force to try to match people. And you have this just insane night that'll be burned in your mind forever, where you get to find out what you're actually going to fly. And I put F-16s first, and I was the very last one in my class to find out what I was getting. So that was fun to stress out and watch everyone else get their assignments. And then I dropped F-16s. Yeah, they actually did it to me on purpose because they knew I wanted it so bad, and they knew I was getting it. So they're like, let's mess with her a little bit and we'll make her go last.
So is this like they post it on the wall and you have to find your name, or is it an email, or is it, a phone call?
Oh, it's so much more dramatic. Okay. So each class does it a little bit different. Mine, you have a projector up there. Your friends and family are there. So other classes come and watch. A lot of times your family will fly in for it.
Oh, boy.
So there's slides. And it usually will be like some embarrassing stuff about you, some photos of you from throughout the year. And then how we did it is it was like Google Earth, and I was at Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi. So someone had automated it where it would start zoomed in on Columbus Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. It would zoom out, and then it would circle around, and it would zoom in on the next base you were going to.
Oh.
So you got to sit there and like watch it zoom out and go all over the place. And then hopefully for me, zoom in on Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, because that's where the F-16 B course was at that time. Now it's at Holloman in New Mexico. But not making me go last wasn't enough. So not only did they do that, but I was worried about becoming a FAPE, a first assignment instructor pilot, which can work out in your favor if you're not quite ranked high enough for the number of fighter aircraft available, but you have the potential. Spending 3 more years at the pilot training base can set you up to have another chance to get a fighter. Mm-hmm. But I would say most people don't want to be a FAPE. Like, you don't want to go from being a student to staying at the same base you were at now instructing students. That's just not what most people want. And I was worried that that was going to happen. So they zoom out of Columbus, they circle around, they zoom back in on Columbus. And then they zoom out and hop over to Phoenix. Oh. To Luke Air Force.
Yeah, that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, very dramatic. That's why I will remember it forever.
I feel like we should watch that on TV. Like, it should be a reality show or something. That would be horrific. And
yeah, when I graduated, it was early 2011. So I have some like grainy pictures from that night. It's not recorded at all. But now you can see some really great videos of drop nights on social media.
Oh,
and
sure.
They're really fun to watch.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, so you get the F-16. It's the airplane you want. How's it feel to walk up to one for the first time knowing that that's going to be your airplane and you're going to go fly this thing? I mean, that has to be quite a feeling.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of just like how awesome that jet is, and it feels surreal, but also stressful because you know that this is going to be harder than everything you've done so far. But there's a lot of excitement at the beginning. And then I think once you start flying, it starts to be a reality check of just how much more challenging that jet is to fly than the T-38. And everyone has to work through that for a while.
What's the, when you said T-38, I looked at Margaret and I actually said, I love T-38. I think they're cool airplanes, but
yeah.
That has to be quite a performance jump to go from the T-38 to the F-16. What was that hard to get used to, or were you kind of ready for it?
It's definitely hard to get used to. I think how fast the jet gets fast, as we like to say, it can get away from you very quickly. And the fact that it can pull 9 Gs on a dime is also pretty dangerous as a student. And so you can't just light the AB roll and pull as hard as you want without being ready, because you will G-lock. You will hit 9 Gs instantaneously. And it's a pretty big risk for, I would say, students and inexperienced F-16 pilots. And it's also a hard aircraft to land. And you're coming in fast. The angle of attack is weird. You got your nose in the air for the aero brake. I don't know. There's just a lot happening. And it just takes everyone some time. And I'm trying to remember how many rides we had in a D model with 2 seats where we had an instructor in the back.
I was just wondering about that.
Yeah. I think we soloed on our 6th flight, if I remember correctly.
Okay. 6. That's what it takes.
Oh, yeah. So you mentioned AB and you're talking about the afterburner.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what it's like to light that afterburner for the first time? Because that, you know, for those who don't know, that's, you know, the flame shooting out of the back of the engine. That has to be like a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, I think the first time you do an AB takeoff, you know, because we can take off in mill power, which is full throttle without the afterburner lit, and the jet still accelerates like crazy, especially if you're in a clean aircraft, as in you don't have external fuel tanks on the outside, or you don't have ordnance hanging. Like, it's just slick, a slick wing Viper. The acceleration is crazy even in mill power. But then you do an AB takeoff, and you have to be careful to not overspeed your gear, because like, you'll rotate, and by the time you have, like, you know, positive climb rate and you're looking around, you're like, okay, got to put the gear up. And then the time it takes for the gear to go up and the doors to close, you're pushing 300 knots, which is the overspeed. So, especially if it's cold, you have to be really careful to get the gear up immediately.
Wow, that's incredible. You're also talking to people who fly an airplane that doesn't go 300 knots.
So, right,
you know,
right.
If we go 300 knots, something bad has happened. And,
it's not good.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you're hitting that by the end of the runway. So it is crazy.
Wow. Did you end up having your own, while you're in what I would call your you know, squadron, your regular squadron, did you have your own personal jet, or was it you just kind of took whatever tail number was given to you that day?
Yeah, so most pilots get their name on the side of a jet at some point, and that's kind of like their jet, and I'm using air quotes, because it's really whatever is available. If the jet with your name on it happens to be available and scheduled to fly in the go, as in like the group of flights launching, say one morning or one afternoon that you're scheduled to fly in, they will try to pair you up. But when you have multiple mission sets going on with different training objectives and pilots are moving between those, and you know, you need an experienced flight lead over here and you need an instructor over here, and like maybe your tail number has bombs loaded up on it and external fuel tanks, but you need to go do a dogfighting mission. So it happens out, like a lot of the time you just don't end up flying your tail, with the exception of the Thunderbirds. We're all in clean jets all the time. You know, no tanks on the outside unless the D model, the two-seater, gets put in the lineup, because that seat takes away some gas. So we will put an external centerline fuel tank on. But in that squadron, you get your name on the jet. There's so few pilots. It's just so different. We almost always would fly our assigned aircraft in the Thunderbirds.
The stories we have today are really interesting, but before we go any further, I do want to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor. They are some of the people who help make the Green Dot possible, and that is Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, you can save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. Thank you again so much to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot and helping make it possible. Now let's get back to the rest of the story.
I have so many questions. I know we're rapidly approaching a part two, but we got a little bit more time here yet today. But I'm like, we have to get into the Thunderbird jet, and yeah, I mean, so
I know that always happens.
You know, and I have so many questions. Like, I wanted to ask you about mid-air refueling and stuff like that, which sounds incredibly hard.
So maybe we just go into, how did you end up in the Thunderbirds?
Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot happened. So, you know, I go through this time. My first combat squadron was in Japan, in Misawa. Mm-hmm. And I did struggle there. Like, I just struggled a lot with my confidence, with questioning if I was in the right career field, with just being new. In hindsight, and talking to other people that were stationed with me there, they actually thought I was doing well as far as in the jet. But you could not have convinced me of that during that time.
Mm-hmm.
I go on to my next assignment in Fort Worth, Texas, and I go through just the most transformative 3 years of my life. It's still up to this point. I think I came out of this assignment where I felt like I really struggled. I was at a low point of feeling like a failure, honestly, feeling failure on a level I hadn't ever experienced before. But I'm also building experience in the aircraft during that time. So I become a flight lead, which means I can lead around a four ship of F-16s. I could take a four ship into combat, so four jets. So that, you know, is a little boost of confidence. I get through that. I get to Texas and I deploy very quickly after getting there, go to Afghanistan. And that is stressful, but it also is a place that gives you confidence because you actually get to do the mission.
Mm-hmm.
I have an extremely supportive group of guys in that squadron. It's a reserve squadron, but I was there as an active duty person. So most of them were very experienced. And there just wasn't a lot of that, like, trying to prove yourself, jockeying for position that happens with young fighter pilots.
Sure.
And so it just felt like a lot less egos,
yeah,
honestly. And it felt, I guess, psychological safety, honestly, is the best way to describe it. It felt like a place where you could admit when you needed help. You could ask people to spend extra time, you know, mentoring you. You felt very safe to admit your mistakes. And it just allowed me to thrive at a level I hadn't experienced previously. And so all of these things started to embolden me, getting confidence in the jet. I got to spend a summer flying in Poland and flying their jets, instructing their pilots, which felt like a big risk to me, but also very exciting. And it went well. And so just all these things are building my confidence.
Yeah.
I'm at the end of my time in Texas. I have my follow-on assignment to go teach at the B course to teach new F-16 students at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. And I see this email that the Thunderbirds are hiring. Now, mind you, this was not the first email that the Thunderbirds sent. They come from Air Force Personnel Center, which sends out all sorts of emails for different job opportunities. And I usually didn't read them, I'll be honest. I just deleted them. I had a lot of other stuff to worry about. And I just wasn't, you know, looking for, I knew what my next move was. I didn't need to be looking at like these special duty assignments and stuff.
Yeah.
So I opened that one for whatever reason. I see the Thunderbirds are hiring. I read the requirements and I meet all of them.
Yeah.
And the applications were due in like 5 business days because it was the last. Hey, dumb. You missed all of our other emails. Last chance.
Yeah.
The Thunderbirds was always something that I had been intrigued by. There was a guy that I was friends with that had applied when I was in Misawa, Japan. And I had all these questions for him when he came back from going through the application process. And then while I was deployed, there was another guy deployed with us at the same time who was also going through the application process.
Yeah.
And I had all these questions for him.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up getting hired. And despite asking these questions, because I was curious and intrigued and it sounded exciting, I literally didn't tell anyone it was something I wanted to do because I had a lot of doubt around whether I could fly at that level.
Yeah.
It's intimidating.
Yeah, there's a phrase out there, tell no one till it's done, right? So you can't keep it to yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of like I've flipped my mindset on that a lot now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now when I want something, I just ask and I'm like, what's the worst I can say?
Yep.
No. I mean, reference speaking at Oshkosh for the women's
for lunch. Women Venture, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for Women Venture. The first time I went to Oshkosh, Eileen Collins was up on that stage.
Yep.
And I remember sitting in the back and talking to Stephanie Getz and being like, I really want to speak at this event. Like, this is my ideal audience.
Yeah.
And then I reached out to you afterwards, right? And I was like, just putting this feeler out there. I would have never done that years prior. So anyway, we digress. But so I think this is a good short story to tell. I know we're almost out of time, but.
Oh, we're good. We're good.
Okay. I see the email. I have this moment. I had been really, really forcing myself for that 3-year assignment to recognize the physical feeling of like excitement when I was like, oh, this looks like something really cool.
Yeah.
Because that would quickly be followed by all the reasons I shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
All the self-doubt, all the reasons someone else was more qualified. And so I had just forced myself through repetition until it became a habit where I would recognize that. I would feel all the doubt. And then I would try to zoom out and create perspective for myself where I would be like, wait, what will I regret not doing like 6 months from now or a year from now?
Yeah.
And what's the worst thing that could happen if I take this risk? and what is my end goal? Like, what am I really trying to do with my life here? And just like taking the time to build that perspective, that was the thing that gave me the courage to go to Poland and like do all of these other things that I had done over those 3 years. And so that was like such a noticeable moment for me where I saw those things happen, the excitement, the feeling of I was wanting to do this, the immediate self-doubt and the fear and the apprehension. So I go to my boss, who I had a great relationship with, and we had done career counseling and kind of mapping out my plan and all this stuff. And I go to his office and I'm like, hey, sir, so I saw an email today, the Thunderbirds are hiring. And he looks at me like, I've literally never mentioned this to him before. I worked for him for like 2 years. He's like, so Mace, do you want to apply? And again, I'm still like on this fence of these two conflicting emotions of excitement and fear. So I say, I think so. Like, I'm Ron Burgundy.
Yeah.
And so I was tossing the ball back to him to get his vote of confidence.
Right.
And I was about to move to my next base. You know, I think I was like 3 months out from moving. He could have very rightfully so been like, hey, Mace, we should have talked about this sooner. Holloman is expecting you.
Yeah.
Maybe you should apply next year. Also, you're like almost up to the deadline for the application. But instead, he was like, you'd be amazing for this job. What can I do to help you get your application in on time?
That's fantastic.
Wow. And I mean, that one decision of him to say that sentence, that changed my life.
Yep. Wow. Yeah. That's so cool.
So you mentioned your call sign.
Yes.
What can you tell us about your call sign? I know that's something you don't always ask people about. What is your rule about talking about your call sign?
Yeah, so there's a tradition in fighter pilot culture that we only share our full call sign story in person over a beverage. And I think there's two reasons that came about. One is that sometimes it's like something you don't want to tell your mom about. I think a lot of people in this audience probably know, but fighter pilot call signs generally come from something dumb that you did, either in the jet or on a work trip, maybe involved alcohol, maybe involved a night in jail. Like, those are extreme examples, but sometimes it's like stories that you don't want to tell mom and grandma. And so people will like stick hard and fast to this rule to avoid telling them.
Yep.
And then I also think it's a ploy to get free beer, right? You're like, you gotta buy me a drink and then I'll tell you. That being said, what I'm doing now is obviously storytelling and I'm getting on stages and all the thing. So I've told, or I normally tell the call sign story in its full detail, all the things when I give a keynote, because I think it's a story that a lot of lessons can come from. And it was really pivotal in my career. But I also know I've teased this forever and people are like, how long can you, like, you can't be a speaker and a public figure and all these things and just never tell this story to anyone. So I have the Cliff Notes version that I'll give you. I decided to kind of break tradition, which whatever, people can be mad about it. And I have a book coming out later this year and I tell the whole story in the book, because when you write 70,000 words and the goal is to be authentic and vulnerable and just open about the highs and the lows and all the things, I don't think you cannot tell the call sign story. So it's in there. But to summarize it now for the people that are like, okay, get on with it. MACE is an acronym. I won't tell you exactly what it stands for. You can get that in a keynote or in the book. But basically, talking about, you know, the jump in power from the T-38 to the F-16, my first mission in Japan was a dogfighting flight. And I did the same basic skills I had learned when I was flying the F-16 in the middle of summer in Phoenix. But now I'm in a different engine that had more thrust. Mm. It's also December in northern Japan. It's very cold. Turns out if you just light the afterburner, push the throttle up as far as it will go and then leave it there, you will go supersonic when you shouldn't be supersonic and you will pull 9Gs for a really long time and you will nearly G-lock.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was
okay, I'm buying the book just to read this.
I was going
to
say, so we can read all about it in your book that's coming out soon?
Yeah, you can. And I describe it every little detail, like what I was thinking, what I was looking at, and how it all happened. And then I think the aftermath from it is more serious than the event itself, because that was really like I said, that happened so early when I got to my first assignment.
Yeah.
That really was a big contributing factor that sent me into that spiral of imposter syndrome and self-doubt.
Can I do this? Can I not do this? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was evidence in front of my face, like, oh, you just made a big mistake that could have had serious repercussions.
Sure. Well,
yeah, to shake you. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So now you go and you try out for the Thunderbirds. I mean, that's something that, again, that's like actually trying out for the Packers Hall of Fame team or something to that level. You know, how does that go? And what was your experience there?
It was really intimidating, not going to lie. And it was funny to be on the other side of it then once I did make the team, because the current team has so much influence and so much of a role in who gets hired. And they're your peers. Like, a lot of them you might know from previous assignments. But in that role, when you're what we call an appy, an applicant, they have to be like, they're still friendly, but they're evaluating you, right? Like,
yeah.
It's not just your check ride history or the bro check where everyone calls around to people who know you and asks what your reputation is, or like all the stuff on paper and your records that you submit in the application. It's how are you to hang out with all the time? We're going to be on the road together 240 days a year. Personality conflicts can just be massively disruptive in that environment when it's such a small team and you're together all the time. So a lot of it is trying to evaluate how people will fit in personality-wise, because you do need leaders in that group. You also can't have everyone wanting to be the leader, right?
Yeah. Right.
Because it's not going to work. So trying to balance all of that, they brought back flying tryouts my last year on the team. So when I applied, we did not have a flying tryout. They kind of were under the mindset that you're experienced fighter pilot, you don't have anything in your records that should make us question your flying ability. We can teach you to do the Thunderbird isms. This is a very different kind of flying. We had some issues where sometimes people just don't get to the level they need to be at with the formation and the maneuvers and stuff. So when I was on my last year on the team, we decided to bring back that flying tryout as another screen. Some of it is actually evaluating how they do with trying to fly loops and rolls and formation and all these things that we do during the tryout. Another part of it is evaluating how much preparation they put in and how they deal with just being really bad again. Because you are going back to feeling like a beginner. And if you're applying to the team, you're an experienced pilot. So you've kind of gotten past that beginner phase for a while. And some people really struggle with going back to being bad again.
Yeah, that has to be a hard pill to swallow, you know.
It's humbling to say that.
I was just going to use the word humbling. Yeah, you have to kind of humble yourself and say, okay, I got to get kind of back to where I was at the beginning and start over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. How did you find out that you were accepted?
I was the supervisor of flying, so the SOF is what we call it, at my unit in Texas. And so I had been told that morning to go out and drive the airfield before our first line started taxiing out. So, you know, just to check for any FOD, make sure the airfield's just good to go for our first jets to taxi out. So I'm out there in the truck with the light on the roof. I just driven down the runway, had just gotten out of the control movement area back to like the ramp where anyone can drive. I'm about to go through the fence to like leave the fenced in part of the airport, and my cell phone rings.
Oh, jeez.
Now, mind you, I wouldn't normally take a phone call at that moment. Luckily, I'm like not on the runway or on a taxiway or anything. I'm just on the edge of the ramp. So I see it's the executive officer for the Thunderbirds phone number. So I'm like, oh God, I have to take this call. So I pull over, I put my flashers on. Don't worry, I didn't do anything crazy. And I answer it and I say hello. And all I hear is just people cheering in the background. So I'm on speakerphone and the whole current officer corps, the 12 officers on the team that year in 2018, all are just like yelling, congratulations.
Aww. That's awesome.
But then I don't know what position I got hired. Because they were interviewing for three spots, the wingman number 3, the opposing solo number 6, and the narrator number 8. And they do ask you during the interview process which position you would like, but they ultimately decide themselves based on those personalities and kind of just fitting the puzzle together.
Sure. Yeah.
So you may or may not get the position you want. Mm-hmm. I did say I wanted to be a solo pilot, and I think I was like, God, this is crazy. Thank you. And then I was like, wait, what position am I? It was number six, the posing solo. So also my first choice, which was just, you know, cherry on top.
That's so fantastic.
I asked you about your name on the jet earlier, but how does it feel walking out to your F-16 the first time you see it, and it's a Thunderbird, and your name's on it? That has to be one heck of a feeling.
Yeah, that was, I think at that point, it was really just excitement, because I was pretty sure I could learn the flying I needed to do, because I did have, you know, almost 1,000 hours in the jet at that point. But it is just, it's a lot of pressure. You know, it's along with this excitement of like, holy crap, I actually made it. This is really happening, because you get that phone call and you don't show up for your first flight there for like 6 more months. And then there's still some time before your name gets put on the jet. For a while, we just fly with our tail number printed where those numbers normally go. You know, you see the number with the stars around it on the side of the jet. There's kind of some ceremonial stuff that has to happen where you go through the training program. And then they bring the whole Delta, the six jets together in formation. And we have a cake, and all the new people get their red helmets, and you get your actual numbers put on the jet at that point. So it doesn't happen like day one, the first time you fly a red, white, and blue jet. There's some stuff that has to happen before that.
That almost makes it more meaningful. You know,
it does.
To earn it. You know,
you've struggled for several months to learn how to fly upside down 150 feet off the ground and fly 3 feet from another airplane while doing a loop. And it's hard.
Wow. I like I said, we have to get you back for a second episode. This is, you're just absolutely amazing to talk to. But I do want to make sure we talk about your book. You mentioned the book earlier. Can you tell us the name of the book, where you can get it, and anything you'd like us to know about it?
Yeah. So it's been already, when we're recording this, we're still about 5 months out from the book releasing. So I'm not sure exactly when this episode is releasing, but it comes out September 9th. I've been working on it for about 2.5 years at this point. So when it releases, it will actually be a 3-year endeavor. Publishing is quite the slow industry, but it also is just a massive lift.
Yeah.
So it is, I would describe it as memoir meets self-help. It's called The Flip Side, How to Invert Your Perspective and Turn Fear into Your Superpower. And it's 12 chapters. Every chapter starts off with some sort of story. The call sign story is in there. Hitting a vulture and putting 2 massive holes in the side of my jet is in there. The closest call I've ever had that could have had catastrophic results, not my call sign story, another a near head-on collision, that one's in there.
Oh, geez.
Deployment story is in there. So I kind of went through my whole aviation life, and I was like, I've experienced so many things in 13 years. Like, what are the ones that really stick out as really transformative or scary, or I learned a ton from them? And so each chapter kicks off with one of those. And then the bulk of the chapter, though, is pulling the lessons from them, kind of the mindset, the tools, all of these things that helped me navigate those experiences. And then we base them in human psychology. It's kind of why they work and why we think the way we do, like why we experience fight or flight, or why we fall into that imposter syndrome feeling, or like how we can control our emotions to respond in a productive way when something bad happens, reference like an emergency in an airplane. But then it's all translated into things that people can use in their day-to-day life, no matter what they're working on, whether it's in an airplane or not.
Yeah, I would say like when I'm going through my pilot training, there are a lot of things that I learned that get pulled into your everyday life then too. So
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's great that you put all of these stories together and that people can read them and see your perspective and kind of know that, like you said earlier, it's okay if you fail. It's okay if you have these thoughts or these feelings, but they're normal and you can learn from them. And here's where the positives come out. I think that's awesome.
I just realized I had so much when I started speaking, and I really saw how much it resonated with people, and I saw what they were doing because of it. I was like, that was one 45-minute speech. That like scratches the surface of all the things we could be talking about. And then again, sharing so much on social media and just seeing little tips and tricks and stories that you could tell really impacted people, I was like, there's got to be a way to put these together where it can reach people who will never find themselves in a keynote audience.
Yeah.
And a book seemed like the best way to do that. And then my final book plug, I know I said September 9th. So pre-orders are open right now.
Yep.
And my publisher tells me that pre-orders are very, very important for books. It's kind of, I did not know this until I became an author. What you sell before the book is actually available, which people are like, what? I'm going to buy a book now and it's just going to show up in my mailbox 6 months from now. I'm like, yes, that is what happens. That projects to retailers how many books they should buy to put in their stores. It also determines bestseller lists like the New York Times, which, like I said, now I'm telling people when I have big goals instead of keeping it a secret. My goal is to make the New York Times bestseller list.
Heck yeah.
So that's awesome. If you think you'll ever buy a book, or if you want to buy it for Christmas next year for someone, or gifts for students or anything, a pre-order would be amazing. I'd be very grateful.
Where can we go if we want to order a book, or where can we go if we want to ask you, you know, invite you or book you to be a speaker? Where should we go?
Yeah. So my website is pretty easy to remember. It's just macecurran.com. So call sign last name. When you go to that website, you'll see info about the book pop up, but the book does have its own landing page with a bunch of like cool stuff I'm giving away to incentivize people to pre-order because people really want to wait for that immediate gratification. So that's just macecurran.com/flipside. So just, you know, the main part of the title of the book. But you can find me on social media. I'm so easy to find on the internet. It's probably unsettling. But Mace_Curran on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, and I put out a ton of content around the same things that the book talks about. I'm anywhere from 4 to 5 times a week I write stuff. So lots of stuff out there.
Well, Mace, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you for everything you're doing. And really, whether you realize it or not, what that F-15 was to get you inspired to fly is what you're doing for other young women and everybody. Is you're being that F-15 for other people in different ways, whether it was your Thunderbird career, speaking, and now the upcoming book. And that's really important. It's important for people to do that and have that sort of person they can look to and say, you know, I can do that. I know she's humble, but our Margaret here is also an F-15 in that way. So it's important to have, you know, people we can look to for inspiration, and you are certainly one of them.
Yeah, I'm just happy Jeannie Lovett brought you over to the WAI booth 3 years ago, so I got to meet you, and that we stay connected all these years.
Yeah, absolutely. I've forgotten that that's where we initially met. Now I remember that it was at the booth at WAI, which is crazy because I just got to give a keynote there a week ago, and another full circle moment. It felt very much like the Women Venture moment did, where I had previously been in the audience and I always wanted to get up on the stage because I know like there is no audience I would rather inspire than a bunch of other women in aviation, right?
Yep.
And it was awesome.
Now, it's been great to see your trajectory too. So I give you all the props in the world and continue to look forward to working with you.
Awesome. I am excited. I will be there again in July. So if anyone wants to come to Oshkosh, I'm doing a bunch of meet and greets and giving away signed book plates. And I have some custom flip side patches, all to kind of just get the word out there about the book that will be coming out like 6 weeks after.
That's awesome.
If you see me there, I will probably have book plates and patches on me for all those people that pre-order.
That's enough to get me excited to pre-order. So yeah,
absolutely. Yep,
absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. And thank you for what you're still doing. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. And we'll see you all in Wisconsin in a few months.
Well, sounds good.
Thanks, Michelle.
And for all those who are tuning in and keep leaving us great comments and just wonderful feedback, whether they're online or when I see you in person, thank you so much. We appreciate all of you listening. And we will catch you next time when we're cleared to land on the green dot.